some of the stars through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey everybody, welcome back to a fresh new episode of Rated G Radio. I'm your host, Garrett Miller. Tonight we've got a fantastic show for the next hour. We're going to be joined by best-selling author Matthew Palamary, and he's going to be talking to us about one of his new books. The one we're talking about tonight is called Night Whispers. I had to use my night vision goggles to actually read the book last night because I could not put it down. But we're going to bring Matt on in just a couple of moments. I wanted to give you kind of the roadmap of where we've been earlier this week, also where we're going. So if you missed anything, you can always tune in on the archives. The shows are always available on demand for the rest of this year. So you got, you know, 360 some odd days to enjoy them. Monday, we had Dr. Annie Ulrich on with her energy update. Yesterday, we have a gentleman I'm proud to call a friend, but he's a relatively new radio broadcaster, podcaster, whatever you want to call it. But his name is Scott Fullerton. He hosts a show called Left of Straight. It's an LGBT-focused show on Blog Talk Radio on Tuesdays. But he's got a brand new show he's bringing to the UBN network out of Los Angeles. And Scott was my impromptu guest last night, and we had a fantastic time talking about his new show, the new Derek and Romaine 2.0 podcast that I listen to all the time, and so much more. So if you would like to hear a little bit about Scott's radio programs, I encourage you to check out last night's show. Tomorrow night, we're going into what we call a new phase of programming. One of the things that we did a little bit last year, not a lot of, but we just kind of dipped our toe in the water, was called, I called it Super Gay Radio, because I would, you know, I'd get a chance to actually say Super Gay Radio. And then we'd talk to people in the LGBT community. Well, one of our popular guests or guest co-hosts is Mr. Rob Watson, who hosts his own show on Saturday night called OutInSantaCruz.com. Rob had had me on his show, and so I had him on mine. And we had such a great time and such a fantastic response from the people who were listening into the show, both live and in Technicolor, you know, on demand, that I said, Rob, you know, this once-a-month thing looks like it's, you know, kind of cool. What do you think if we, you know, just really saturated the market and did it once a week? So he says, that's great, but if you do this Super Gay Radio thing every week, you're going to offend, you know, probably more people than you want to. So why don't we call it Rated LGBT Radio instead? So I said, Rob, this is why you get paid the big money. So starting tomorrow, we're doing our first ever Rated LGBT Radio, and I promise not to do the other thing any longer. And you know, I might have a cup of tea and forget, but we're going to have Rated LGBT to Rated G. Well, see, now it's, I'm just all kerfluffle. Rated LGBT Radio with Mr. Rob Watson tomorrow night. And Rob also is a nationally recognized columnist on the Huffington Post. His articles are regularly picked up on Yahoo and lots of the other big online publications. So he's going to bring a little serious to, you know, the wacky fun that I try to bring to the table every day. And then Friday, we're going to have Mr. Brad Schechter. He is an actor-turned-musician out of Hollywood, and we're doing a premiere of his brand-new album on the Friday Night Dance Party. That's at 7 o'clock. So there you go, folks. That's how the week is shaping up. I want to send a couple of special shout-outs to Paul Emery in upstate New York, Tony out of Hackensack, New Jersey, and then also my dear friend Sheena Metal out of the LA Talk Radio world. We had a fantastic meeting this afternoon about a new project we're going to work on, not having to do with radio, as a matter of fact, but a new project that we're going to work on having to do with filming stuff. And I'll tell you more about it as we possibly can. And now we're going to introduce our VIP guest of honor, Mr. Matthew Palamary. I'm going to tell you, I think this is a first for the show. I've never, in the 4 years I've done this, I've never had a Man of the Year be my guest of honor. And Matt was named the Man of the Year in 2000 by the San Diego Writers Monthly magazine. He's been on countless radio shows, countless TV shows. He's won several awards. He's even had one of his books turned into a play. I'm hoping we'll have a chance to talk about that. He is so fascinating. He writes murder mysteries, and then he also writes these fantastic spiritual types of books as well. And I could go on, but it would take probably another hour to finish all of Matt's accomplishments. So I'll say without further ado, Matt, welcome to Rated G Radio. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for the awesome introduction. professionalism.
I am so thrilled to have you here. I need to do a quick shout out. I always try to give big props, mad props to anybody who, you know, connects the dots here. And
sure.
My dear friends, Jeff and Jill, Jeff
yeah.
Michaels, Jill, they have been dear friends of mine ever since I moved to California. And Jeff has been on the show before. He's a celebrated author as well. He said, you know, you've got to have Matt on because Matt is a great storyteller. He's fascinating. He's absolutely awesome. He'll be a great guest. And I said, I would love to do that, Jeff. Thank you for the recommendation. And then he connected us in person. I think we'd been, you know, stalking each other on social media for a while, but we got a chance to actually shake hands back this fall at the Southern California Writers Conference, I think down in Irvine or Newport Beach, something like that. So
yes.
It was fun to connect with you there. But by the way, Jeff has a brand new book that just hit Amazon today. We're really here to sell Matt's books tonight, so just a real quick plug for Jeff. But he's got a book called Becomes Us All, Visions of Death and Life. It just hit Amazon today, and it's by author Jeff Michaels. On Kindle Unlimited, it's actually free. Paperback is $8.99, so go pick up a copy of that. And we'll have Jeff on later in the year to talk about that. But let's talk about you. This is my first chance to really visit with you. You've been an awesome correspondent with me on the email getting the show set up, but I don't really know a whole lot about you, Matt. Can you tell us, you know, where it all started?
Well, I'm a perspiring writer, and I grew up, I have a memoir called Spirit Matters, which is also an audiobook. And I grew up in Boston, in Dorchester, the same neighborhood as Mocky Mock.
And the Funky Bunch.
Yeah, exactly. Mark Wahlberg and Donnie, they're from my neighborhood. But they're younger than me, but they grew up very close. So that's where I come from. And I went through lots of tough stuff. And to make a long story short, I had a fascination with both psychedelics and shamanism. And as fate would have it, I grew up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood where there was supposedly spirituality, but there really wasn't. And I ended up in the jungles of the Amazon, where I've been going for 15 years now, doing shamanic plant diets and going through very intense experiences that have changed my life for the better.
Okay, well... Because I think, you know, just growing up in Boston, hanging out with Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, watching the Celtics play and all of that is great, because that's just a natural transition to shamanism and going down to the jungles of Peru. So how did that connection come about for you?
Well, I was researching shamanism. I took an honors course in anthropology.
Okay.
And it was called A Forest of Symbols, Orientation and Meaning to South American Indian Religions. And I was fascinated with what I learned in that course, and it spurred me further to explore. So there's the whole mythology of lycanthropy, werewolves, which goes back to shapeshifting. And I discovered that shapeshifting and visionary plants of the Amazon, there was a connection between the two.
Oh.
And South America has the greatest concentration of visionary plants that we know of in the world. And so so I was actually exploring the werewolf mythology when I got into lycanthropy and shapeshifting, and it brought me to the Amazon, and I started reading about these plants, and I was fascinated. So the one I'm sure everybody's heard of at some point is called ayahuasca. And I researched that at the UCSD library down here in San Diego, and I spent 10 years researching it through, you know, journals and this and that. And then I got an opportunity to experience it. And then I got to start going to the jungles regularly to do extended shamanic plant diets, which have changed my life for the better.
Okay, so what is a shamanic plant diet?
Well, so you go in... And the ones I do are like 10 days. It's a purification diet. And even doing the ayahuasca is a purification on multiple levels. So you go for 10 days with either get oatmeal, quinoa, or rice twice a day, a baked or boiled plátano, you know, which is a non-ripe bananas, and then every 2 or 3 days a piece of chicken or fish, maybe every other couple of days here and there. It comes in and out. No soap, no shampoo, no scents of any kind, no salt, no fruits, no sugars, no toothpaste, no nothing like that. And you have to take you get these crushed leaves and you take plant baths. And then every day you drink a pitcher of a plant or a particular kind of plants that have particular properties, healing or cleansing or fortifying or whatever it happens to be. And this, by the way, is a historic tradition. And then roughly every other night you meet with the shaman and you do a ceremony drinking the ayahuasca, which is done in a ceremony.
So are you – now you're doing this down in the jungle or is this something you're able to do at your – okay, so it's not like hanging out in the backyard in San Diego.
No. This is in the Peruvian Amazon, in the middle of the Amazon rainforest, away from everything.
When someone told you about doing this cleanse for the first time, did this just go like, this is what I've been waiting for, or did you think this is the craziest thing you've ever heard?
Well, no, it was more like I can't not do this. I have to know this. Well, one of the primary differences, you talk about religion and spirituality and this, that, and the other, okay? The difference between organized religion, and I'm quoted this often, the difference between organized religion and shamanism is that organized religion I'm getting my words all mixed up like you were earlier. So buckle
Sorry
what
about
you
that.
Said. No, it's funny. Organized religion is based on the words of prophets. And so the prophet has a visionary experience. They give the word. Somebody gets that word and reinterprets it and writes it down to somebody else who reinterprets it this way and that way. And by the time it gets handed down, it's been reinterpreted a gazillion times. Shamanism is based on direct experience. So the shaman says, instead of reading about, you're the blind Jesus, I guarantee you, if I went out in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights and fasted, I'd be talking to God. Guarantee it. So shamanism is about direct experience, and a lot of things that were lost when Western culture infringed upon indigenous cultures in both North and South America, a lot of truly ancient prehistoric wisdom and knowledge was passed away. And so this was what I've been striving for, is trying to discover some of it. So when you do these shamanic plant diets, you learn things in ways that are non-rational, if that makes any sense. I can get into the whole psychology and physiology of that if you want to. That's a whole other area. But,
I would love it. Well, you know, and I was reading just a tiny little bit, because, I mean, I've heard the word shaman before, but I've not really learned much about it. So you're really my foot in the water to learn about this tonight. But it was saying it was like a technique of religious ecstasy. And to me, that just sounded fascinating from a learning standpoint, but also from an experiential standpoint as well. And hearing that you're going through this diet, the diet actually sounds very healthy.
It ultimately is. You go through a lot of oftentimes with ayahuasca, you have it coming out both ends. And in the jungle, they call it la purga, which is the purge. So you get cleansed, and there are other plants that have other similar qualities in different ways, depending on how strong you're going to work on a particular aspect of yourself. But you do get very clean. And what happens is the bodies, they bring you your food, and you spend most of your time alone, except when you do the ceremony. And as the days go by, you become physically weaker, and the boundaries between your conscious and your subconscious become blurry. And in fact, in indigenous cultures, waking, sleeping, dreaming, there's no difference between any of them. Even in waking life, they consider it, they give it equal weight.
Wow.
So as you spend that time in the jungle, you really become part of the jungle. I mean, even, you're taking these plants and you're not taking anything else, and you start to smell like the jungle. I had a girlfriend a few years ago, and when I came back, one of my exes, and she said to me, "You smell like the jungle." And I looked at her, and I got my eyes really wide, and I said, "I am the jungle." I meant it.
Yeah.
You know? And so, there are whole other aspects of it that have been used traditionally in numerous ways, but it's an ancient mode of psychology, spirituality, you name it, it's there.
So when you'd mentioned that you would get a particular, plant and you would drink that for a particular thing that you'd work on, what would be some things that you would want to work on to, cleanse yourself of during this fast?
Yeah, well, what happens is, and it is a fast, usually you use 10 pounds. What happens is prior to heading into the actual jungle, which is quite a trek in and of itself to get there, the shaman sits down with you and he interviews you. And he asks you and he looks at you and he gives you an examination and he says, this is what I suggest for you. Here's a little funny side story. This guy I've been working with now for 15 years, you know, we're very close. We're like family now. Because I've been going down for so long, I've worked with most of their plants now and I've been through most of the experiences and they're all ordeals. So I went to him this year and I said, you know, I'm thinking I'm maybe taking it easy this year. It's, you know, it's been for a lot of hard years. And he looks at me, he looks me in the eye and he says to me, we're going to hit you hard.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I'm like, in my head, I'm like, thanks, bro. And we're both laughing. And,
right.
And you know, he's been leading me down this path for all these years. You know what I'm saying?
So what did you go through this last time?
So this last time, I did 4 group sessions at night with the group, 1 group session during the day, and then I did 2 sessions alone by myself. During the day, they'll only do that after your experience. And even when you do it and you're alone, they have an eye on you. You're safe. One of the whole deals of a good place like this is that you can go whatever you have to go through, and you're in a safe, protected place in a number of ways. I did that, and then every day he gave me this mixture of 5 plants, which were super, super energizing. I maybe slept 3 hours a night and I wasn't tired. I was in this whole other place.
So is it hallucinogenic?
No, but they work together. Like they call ayahuasca the mother of the other plants.
Okay.
So they work together as allies. And they do this by themselves and then combine with that when you get this other effect. And as I say, it's not only psychologically, it's physiologically. Like I did one dieta 1 year with cat's claw, which is known anti-inflammatory, anti-tumor, and a strengthener and a fortifier, you know. So it's in the end, it's all about energy work, and you basically open yourself up to energies of the plants, and you're in their domain where they are the lords and masters, so to speak, or gods and goddesses or spirits or elementals or whatever you want to call them. Including the animals.
So
when
you come back to, you know, civilization and you head back to San Diego, what do you do from a diet or maintenance standpoint to try to prolong the effects of this cleanse as long as you possibly can?
That is a very great and intelligent question. Thank you for asking that, seriously. As a general rule, you should be on the diet for a period of time, as long as you're on the diet, is what you should prepare for. And after, what I mean is that if you're going to be on the diet for 10 days, you should do a cleaner diet for 10 days before and then for 10 days after. And sometimes longer. Like part of the diet is there's no sex, no sugar, no red meat, no lard, no fat. Very cleansing, but if you were to do this diet all the time, it's not healthy over extended periods of time. It's done primarily for this purpose, to put your body in like a chemically pure state.
It's almost like a reset that you're going through.
It is a reset. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what I was saying when I went down this year and did this. I told everybody when I was leaving, this is, in fact, when I saw you and when I met you, that was just like a week before I was leaving.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah, yeah. And
yeah.
So when you get through, you know, your 10 days before, you go down there for the 10 days and you come back and do your 10 days, you know, at what point do you say, okay, I'm going to have a piece of pepperoni pizza again, or I'm going to have a really, you know, fatty triple cheeseburger with a king size fry? Do you ever get to that, or does that 30 days really give you kind of a, you know, I've gone through all of this and now I want to be a little bit more cognizant of what I'm shoving down my pie hole?
Well, yeah, no, I'll give you a good example. And shamanism is all about energy. I tend to have a real affinity for caffeine and cannabis. I drink coffee, and when I smoke cannabis, I'm a writer, and I'm a very disciplined writer. I that fuels me creatively, but I don't like to do that forever. You know, that can have things. So when I get ready to go to the jungle, I stop both of those for, you know, usually a couple of weeks before. And then sometimes I'll go for months and months after when I come back, and I won't. So it depends on how the energy feels and where I'm at, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it totally does.
Yeah, see, one of the things about shamanism, you made that mention about Masters of Ecstasy, which is Mercier Eliade, a famous anthropologist, came up with that expression. He actually has a book, I think, by that title. You become a master at navigating altered states. And when you go into visionary states and different experiences with different things, you have different types of experiences. And when you first go into them, you're totally blown away and overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's unprecedented. It defies rationality. And the more you go back, one of the things about ayahuasca is it's always changing. You can never predict anything it's going to do. But what you learn to do is you learn to navigate. And then that navigation, what you learn in those visions, will start filtering into your dreams and start filtering into your waking life. When it starts filtering into your waking life, you start having what Carl Jung called synchronicities. And so the world starts to sort of blend together, and then your life really becomes magic in a different way because your perspective has shifted and your perspective becomes flexible.
So, okay. Let me ask you this, because you go through this and you're purifying your body. You go through this whole experience. I'm fascinated. I want to go with you next time. So I'm just telling you that right now. Does this differ? Because I have smoked pot probably like 3 or 4 times in my life. It's not for me. So anybody who likes to do it, that's great. It just gives me headaches and I don't feel good doing it. But how would the experience with the plants and the reactions that you get differ from, you know, somebody who says, okay, I'm going to come back and I'm going to do like LSD or something like from the 60s. Because I always picture that as being like a hallucinogenic or a mushroom or something like that. And I don't have experiences with anything else like that. So I don't even know what people experience when they go through that. But how would that differ? Do you have any comparison that you could
share? Yeah, sure, absolutely. I'm an authority on all of them.
Okay,
fair enough. I don't know many people who have done more than all of them than I have.
Okay.
So, in fact, I'm not plugging my book, but I am plugging my book, and then I talk about this evolution of my consciousness in my memoir, Spirit Matters. I talk about how I went, you know, hyperventilating, sniffing glue, LSD, all the whole enchilada. But so different substances have different qualities that they affect you physiologically and psychologically in different ways. You take MDMA, ecstasy. That's considered an empathogen because it mostly affects your moods and emotions and feelings. You can get some little visual stuff, but it's usually just sort of overstimulation. But it's really considered an empathogen. Whereas you have something like LSD or mushrooms, which are called a hallucinogen. Now, LSD comes from originally from a fungus that grows on the rye and ergot, Claviceps purpurea, and it was isolated by Albert Hofmann. And I've discovered over many, many years that it actually acts as an amplifier. To me, there's really no such thing. A lot of people would say, oh, I did acid and it was bad acid and I had a bad trip. Well, that's bullshit. What happened is they had this psychological shit that was suppressed and it came out.
Oh.
The monsters came out of the box. And that's what freaked them out. And there was a lot of things. One of the first people that jumped off a building on LSD was a CIA guy, and he was already psychologically unstable. He had issues, and they dosed him and didn't tell him.
Oh my gosh!
Right? So those are the kind of things that were done that were not responsible. But anyway, so LSD is like an amplifier. And you can have certainly spiritual experiences and openings and revelations, all those things, especially if you're psychologically poised for it. That can be the thing that can set it off in a number of different ways. So it can be a very useful tool. But you take something when you go to mushrooms. Mushrooms, in my humble opinion, and the humble opinion of many others, mushrooms have an intelligence of their own.
Really?
There's a mushroom spirit. the original, if you know this humor, maybe for the listeners anyway, originally a guy by the name of Gordon Wasson found Maria Sabina, who was a curandera in Oaxaca, Mexico. And he was the first Western white man to actually have a hallucinogenic mushroom experience through her. And he wrote an article in either 1953 or 1957, it might have been 1953, Life magazine, and he called them the magic mushrooms. And he had his visionary experience. And she totally honored the spirit of the mushrooms and invoked it to do healings and other things like that. So mushrooms are like that. Ayahuasca has the sort of the highest plant intelligence. That's why it's considered the mother of all the other plants. But the ayahuasca of itself is actually a combination of two plants. One plant is the ayahuasca vine. It's Latin is Bonasteriopsis copy. And it has an MAO inhibitor. And then the other one is Psychotria viridis. That's the Latin name, which is they call chacruna. And chacruna contains DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is psychologically psychoactive. It's hallucinogenic.
Okay.
But it occurs occurs naturally in the human body. So by the letter of the law, your brain is illegal. But that's a whole other story.
Fair enough.
But yeah. But when you mix, this is one of the fascinating things of this whole ayahuasca brew, is when you mix the chacruna with the ayahuasca, the two of them together. If you eat the chacruna by itself, the monoamine oxidase in your stomach will digest it before it can become orally active, and so you can eat it all day and you won't get high on the DMT. But when you mix it with the ayahuasca vine the way that they do, the ayahuasca vine has the MAO inhibitor that allows it to become orally active, and you have about a six-hour experience when you drink it.
Holy cow. So now, does it give you any kind of like hangover or after effects? Or is there anything, you know, that...
Well,
that
the after effect... The after effects are usually intense clarity.
Okay.
In fact, as an example, if you take psilocybin mushrooms at very low doses,
mm-hmm.
it will increase your visual acuity, especially your edge perception. So there's a whole hominid theory that if you're a man ape, so to speak, and you're the one taking the mushrooms and you can see better, you're going to have a little bit of a hunting advantage over others.
How interesting.
So the whole thing about – go ahead.
No, I'm fascinated by that.
So the whole thing about shamanism and working with the energies of the jungle is you more or less give yourself over to the energies of the jungle and they put you through various ordeals. And in the lore of the jungle, that's the price you have to pay to prove that you're worthy of the knowledge and the gifts and the wisdom that they have to give you. And then you learn from these.
And so when you come back to San Diego, you know, and so I know that you've kind of, you know, purified your body and gone through this. Do you use any type of essential oils that are plant-based to continue, you know, your health regime or?
I can. Like, one of the things about the jungle, particularly in Peruvian shamanism, they use Florida water. It's basically a really cheap floral scent cologne, but they've been using it for years for the scent that it has. And then I've done a lot of work with lavender and other oils. It's sort of part of it. But when you do this in the jungle, you generally don't do that. But like they have Palo Santo, which is wood, and it's very sweet smelling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's considered a powerful ally, and you light it on fire, and then you blow it out, and you use the smoke, and it's a smudge, just like American Indians use sage. Same thing, it's very sweet smelling. Yeah. And then when you do the plant bath, typically, sometimes they switch them off, but there's a plant called huayusa. In fact, you can get huayusa tea, which is awesome. It's a great stimulant. But they bring you, you have a bucket, and they fill your bucket, the bottom of your bucket, with these huayusa leaves. And then you crush them up, and then you go to the river and you fill it with water and you let them sit, and then you take plant baths periodically. And it's a sweet smelling. There's nothing I can describe it like. Eucalyptus is the closest, but that's not even close. But just give me an idea what it's like. It's a nice, sweet scent.
I think that's cool. Matt, we are halfway through the show, and we haven't even talked about your book, Night Whispers. I want to take a real quick commercial break, and when we come back... we're finally going to start talking about your writing and your book. So everybody hang tight. This is a little clip from Rainbow Brew out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. Go buy their coffee.
When it comes to coffee, freshness is queen. That's why Rainbow Brew believes you should have the freshest coffee, roasted to order in small batches and delivered to your door within a couple days. Whether you're purchasing for a coffee shop, restaurant, or home, Rainbow Brew is your one-stop shop for fair trade and organic coffee. Offering many unique blends, including AM 950's own Blue State blend. That's Rainbow Brew, the Queen Bean, a proud sponsor of the Morning Grind. Online at rainbowbrew.com. Brew something good today.
Now, I know Matt said that he's a big fan of coffee. So if you're thinking, who is Rainbow Brew? They are a small business operated out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. And when they approached me about coming on the show, I said, this is great, but nobody's going to buy your coffee because coffee beans cannot grow in the frozen tundra of Minneapolis, St. Paul. And they said, believe it or not, smart man, we're going to send you some coffee. So they sent me some of their Rainbow Brew. They've got different flavors. It is amazing coffee. If you go to rainbowbrew.com, actually, go to their Facebook page, like their page, because they're always giving like coupons and dollars off. You can go get some amazing deals on that. But if you place an order, make sure you tell them that you heard them about them on Rated G Radio. They actually have a Rated G Radio happy dance they will do in the shop before they send out your fresh ground coffee to you same day. So that's Rainbow Brew. So I appreciate them being a proud sponsor here on the show. So we're here with Matt, who has a billion books out, has sold a trillion copies. If you're listening to the show live, we've got a link to Matt's Amazon author page, which lists every single book he's written. It's right there. It just says click on Matthew's work here on Amazon here. You click that and it goes there. I've also got a link to Matt's website. You can go and click that and check out all the cool things that he's doing. We haven't even started talking about his book, Night Whispers, which I'd love to dive into. I normally start with authors who I've not talked to before and said, you know, tell me about, you know, when you started writing and all of that. I think I need to do that on episode 2 or 3 or 16 when I bring you back, because I want to make sure we talk about this. You are good enough to send me a copy of the book. I've been reading through it, and I am fascinated that somebody who writes about shamanism and spiritual works writes murder mysteries that are freaky. And that's all I can tell you about my experience so far in Night Whispers. So where did the book come from, and how did you get to this point where you're writing these crazy stories about things that are happening in Boston?
Well, it's set in Dorchester, where I grew up. And in many ways, it's closer to the truth than my memoir, Spirit Matters, is. Not really, but Spirit Matters moves a little quicker. I spend time in Dorchester there in the book. And it is the darkest novel I've ever written. But one of the things that had struck me, there's a theme, is that there are people getting murdered in these Druid ritual murders, these beautiful young women, and then homeless people are disappearing. And nobody cares about the homeless people. And so I wanted to bring attention to the homeless people in a shocking way. Does that make sense?
I think shocking would be putting it mildly. So, you know, I always like a book that captures your attention in, like, you know, they say the first five words, the first five sentences, the first five paragraphs, and the first five pages, and yours absolutely does that. So outside of raising awareness about, you know, serial murders and the homeless issues that our country faces, how did you get inspired to write this particular book?
Well, a couple of things. I read an article in the New York Times some years ago about this guy who was, it was the FBI, and he was like the one-man occult investigator. So he was like sort of the real version of the X-Files, kind of, in a way. But, mm-hmm. You know, and that kind of fascinated me. And then I got the idea, so in a nutshell, without spoiling the whole story, a lot of my friends when I was younger were car thieves, and in the beginning of the story, this kid is about 18. He gets into a car. He doesn't realize it's stolen. They get chased by the cops. His buddy crashes the car. He gets banged on the head. And then when he comes to, he's walking down the street and he hears a homeless guy arguing with himself. And he starts hearing the other side of the argument in his head. So there's this whole supernatural element that's going on. And then I was doing a lot of research on the Druids and some of the rituals they used to do, which were pretty hairy. And so the stories started coming together. One of the things about, getting a little off track, but one of the things about shamanism is that the light and the dark are considered equals. You can't have the light without the darkness. So I'm here to tell you that I have been, in the work that I've done in the jungle, I've been through some of the darkest depths of hell you can not even imagine. And I've also been in some of the most sublime and exquisite heavenly realms that I can't even articulate. And one of the things you learn, if you continue the work in an intense way, is to stay balanced and centered no matter what you are perceiving or happening at the time. So the light and the dark are there for each other. The darker it is, the more the brighter the light shines, and sort of vice versa. But they're complementary elements. One is no better than the other. You know, male, female isn't better than female. They're different types of complementary energies. They need each other, you know, in different aspects to manifest. So I was told some years ago, and it has seemed to ring true, that one of my purposes was, when everything gets to be too light, it's my job to bring in the darkness. And when everything gets too dark, it's my job to bring in the light. And I have to say, I've always been a bit contrary to a lot of things, and I've discovered that to be true to my life in some degree. So this darkness I needed to be explored. I was working through some of my own demons when I was doing it and thinking about it. And one of the things you realize, that's terrifying, is all the people in the world and all the horrific things that go on in the world and the horrific, horrible, monstrous things that people do. Well, we're all connected, and we're all part of the same thing. And anything horrific beyond imagining that you can think of, we're all capable of it. And that's frightening.
That's very frightening. You make that happen with the character Nick. And okay, so and again, we don't want to give away the story, because we want you to go to Amazon and buy Night Whispers, yeah. But at the same time, buy all of Matt's books, so you can, you know, get the entire series tonight. You know, I'm sure you got a birthday or an anniversary or something coming up. We just, you know, passed Christmas and Hanukkah, but the New Year is here, so we need to go and support independent book writers like Matt. So go buy his books. But tell us about some of the characters and why we're going to be so captivated and interested in who these characters are, because you have some very interesting people that you bring into the story, and it's, you know, you have the good guys, you've got the bad guys, but it's the relationships that they have kind of crossing paths with each other that I think, at least to me, was very interesting to read how their lives intertwine. And, you know, it's that 6 degrees of separation of Kevin Bacon. You don't realize how intertwined all of these people really are. But, you know, tell us about the characters.
Sure. Yeah, no, thank you. You're very observant. Seriously. What I did in Night Whispers, and in fact, I'm doing it now in a book I'm dead up in the middle of writing right now. But what I did in Night Whispers is I told it from two points of view. Mm-hmm. So one of the characters is this kid, Nick, that gets banged on the head and he's hearing the voices and he's trying to figure out what's going on. And he starts to follow that path because it's driving him nuts. And the other one is this government investigator who's on the occult task force. The one, if I remember correctly, the U.S. Justice Department one-man occult task force, and he's investigating high-profile murders, and this kid's investigating the missing homeless people and hearing the voices in his head. And so I alternate the chapters. The one chapter's from one, then the next I shift it. And sometimes I flow from one to the other. And it's fun because it's almost like magic. You can do things you want to lead people down a path and make them figure out that this is what's going to happen, and then you want to completely frustrate them. But when you completely frustrate them, you have to play fair with them. And so when you do frustrate them, they go, oh, yeah, of course. It has to make sense when it happens. So there are different things you can do. And one of the fascinating things about being a fiction writer is that fiction, from the point of view character, is all about perception. Shamanism is all about perception. So you get to get into these characters' heads and then perceive the world in their way. And you can play with their perception and play off of each other, which is what I did, which added to the mystery. It's been really popular in Dorchester, where I grew up.
I think it should be required reading in Dorchester, you know, and the autographed copy required reading. So lots of book signings. So I do like the fact that you go back and forth, because I think one of the things that I think sometimes books can do is that you tend to get a little stale, and it's like, okay, now we're dealing with, okay, isn't there anybody else doing anything in the entire world relating to whatever's going on in the book? Nope, it's just that one character. And here you do have these different points of views and the different things that they're going through. And little do they know, all of, you know, these things are happening, you know, that you know, they're just so, they're so close to, but they're not connected. And but you got to read the book to find out what takes place. So you were saying that part of your inspiration for this was some of the dark and yucky things that were going on in your life. So as a writer, now I'm going to ask a writing question here. Finally, it only took us 40 minutes to get to this. So as a writer, when you get ready to write a book that is going to be fiction, do you have what is your process for that? Do you kind of know, okay, I'm going to write this really dark, terrible book because I'm in this dark, terrible place, but at the end there's going to be sunshine and rainbows? Or do you just sit down and write and just say, boy, I hope it works out for these guys because otherwise they're toast?
Well, I wasn't necessarily in a dark and terrible place when I was writing the book, but I was exploring it, if that makes any sense.
Sure, yeah.
You know, in other words, if we're all capable of those horrific things, I'm just going to let my mind go and see what it, kind of shit it turns up, basically. Because, now, go ahead,
Matt.
Well, that's right. I let myself go in those directions and work through those things to try to have some comprehension of how it works. And one of the things, in my humble opinion, about horror writing in general is that it's typically a cautionary tale. There's a bit of a sort of a moral behind most of them. And there are different things, you know, one book could be saying persevere, you know, or one could be saying if you love all the time, you know, your life would be great, whatever it is, you know what I'm saying? Everything has something to say. So part of it is a social statement. This had to do with the fact that how we do treat homeless and high-profile murders. And then some of the stuff when I was researching it was fascinating. Some of the Druid, all the stuff came from these old books I found on Druid practices. So when I go to write a novel, I have usually ends up being about 10 pages of an outline, but it's not structured in any way. Like anybody else who's reading it probably wouldn't make any sense out of it at all. It could have snatches of dialogue or four words about a scene. I mean, it's very loose like that. And then if I find anything in my research that may be relating to it, I just dump it into that whole big file. And then I start to write.
Do you get into like a writing zone for a particular genre that you're writing for, whether it's, you know, a shamanistic tale or a murder mystery, do you have any like guidelines or rules that you create for yourself to, you know, kind of put this magic on paper?
Yeah, well, there's an old saying I'm often quoted. It's not original, but people say, what's the best advice you can give to new writers and all that? And I say, writing equals ass in chair. You have to sit down. You have to be disciplined about it. And in the end, if you stick with it, you realize that it's a dance with your subconscious, and you're learning how to work with your subconscious, and you're learning how to feed it, and you're learning how to trust it. You're learning that if you give it a problem and let it forget about it, it'll come back with an answer and however long it takes. So there's a whole dance of working with your subconscious that makes it all happen. So, you know, for me now, I have a ritual. I've been working on this book nonstop for the past month, the one I'm working on right now. So every morning I get up and I have my coffee, and then I go through my hour or so of the social media stuff, and then I'm on it. And I'm hitting it all day. And then sometimes I'm running around the room or laying on the bed or doing something because it doesn't come smoothly.
Right.
So I do different things to coax it out. Go ahead.
Do you have any type of, today I must do X number of words, or I must write X number of chapters, or I must make X number of points in my writing, otherwise Matt doesn't get a treat?
Yeah, I do all those things in different ways. Like, I was cranking 8 pages a day there for the longest time, but it started slowing down the past week. But that's okay. My minimum is 5 pages. But sometimes there's a lot of lessons I've learned along the way, and I've been at this for quite a while. But, like, one thing you can do, which a lot of writers do, is when you stop at some point, and, you know, your creative energies, they ebb and they flow. Sometimes you just, when you're done after 8 pages, I'm tapped out. I don't want anything else. It takes a lot out of your first draft like that. But, you know, you go through it, you keep getting it out. And then if you quit in the middle of an active scene, then it's really easy for you to pick up on when you're there the next day. I had a great experience last week. I was stuck for about a half a day on this plot point. And I was like, what am I going to do? And all of a sudden, bang, it popped. And next thing you know, I was like banging away, and I had like 5 pages in an hour and a half, you know. It comes
Holy
like
cow.
That. It comes in spurts, you know. It's not a steady stream. But.
So when you get ready to, you know, have the book finished, now, you know, you've written a number of books now. Are you getting better at the point that you're finished with a book to say, okay, this is going to be the book that my editor is not going to redline the entire book, and I'll actually get it back with a big smiley face? So have you changed your writing style at all over the years, or how has that worked for you?
Well, I've actually become that editor.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is I've been teaching now for 25 years at the Southern California Writers Conference and the Santa Barbara Writers Conference. And I've done my own workshops, and I've lectured, and la, 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 la. And I've had really amazing mentors like Ray Bradbury and Charles Schultz. Chuck Champlin, who is the leading L.A. Times film critic for 25 years, is a dear supportive friend. And a lot of other guys like that, Jonathan Winters. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. They were like my writing uncles, and they were all behind me. So I've been teaching for all these years, and I edit books. In fact, I worked with Jeff on one of his books.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I edited. I gave him an overview analysis, and we've worked together, you know, at the conferences and things.
Yep. Yeah, well, I guess maybe let me ask a different question, or ask the question a different way. Because you're so close to your own work, are you able to really see all of the things that need to be changed or fixed along the way to make sure that it's as powerful as it is when we open up a book like Night Whispers and, you know, it's the finished product? Now that you've taught it, you help other people, and, you know, you're a great mentor and a great leader in the community of writers, but from your own work, how objective can you be when you're doing your own critiquing?
Yeah, no, good. That's a really, really good point. Here's the thing. I've worked so much on other people's work that I can bring the same coldness to my own work. In fact, what I tell my students and people and clients when I work with them is that, don't feel bad about this. I'm harder on myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I do have beta readers who will read for me. My sister's the best. She'll go through and go, hey, this is all great, but you missed that thing there. Cause you know, you can miss things and all that. But, I mean, generally,
sure.
You know, it works. But you know, one of the things about being a writer is that you don't want an editor, really, when you're doing your first draft. I always tell my students, just puke on the page. Don't even worry about punctuation. You know, if you have that flow going and the muse is delivering and that flow is happening, that's all that matters at that point. Then you go back and you can go through numerous revisions and polishes. And what I've developed over all these years after working with so many different people in so many different books is that I can bring that same cold objectivity to my work that I can to theirs. I have that different eye. I have 5 different ways that I can look at a book. I just pulled 5 out of my butt. There's a lot of different ways, but I mean, I can look at it from multiple perspectives is my point.
Maybe 16 or even 17. Who knows? I mean, there's,
even
more than
whatever.
5.
Yeah, whatever. Exactly. Maybe even 7 or 11. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
But I can do that. And I'm very precise in what I do in many ways. And it's been taught to me by great mentors over the years. And so I've been taught that way. I worked on it that way. And so now what used to take me 10 to 20 revisions, I can do in 3.
I love that. How long does it take you to write a book?
My average has been 9 months. But this has been a funny thing because I just worked on this one for a month. But now I have to take a couple of weeks off because I'm going up to Santa Barbara to work on another project.
Okay.
And I had to take a month off in November because I had a novel I had to edit for a client. And when I edit someone's novel, I'm totally, Jeff can tell you this, I'm totally wrapped up in it. I just live and breathe it, nothing else, because I need to go through it and check for continuity, and there's big overviews and plot points, and I can do a complete full-on analysis of it. You know, I went to tons of classes and workshops and mentors and this and that, and I've been doing it now for years and years. In fact, I have a book on writing called Fantastic Fiction with a PH. So
I love
it's
that.
Fantastic. Yeah, thank you. It's Fantastic Fiction, a shamanic approach to story structure. And
well, guess what I'm going to go buy on Amazon tonight after the show.
Oh, bless you, my son. It won an International Book Award for the best writing publishing category.
Well, you okay? We're gonna, you know, bow down and give you some mad props here. Can you talk about some of the awards and recognition that you've received over the years? Because literally, when I was going through your bio and your profile, I was like, that will take an hour and a half just to read the awards themselves. But to give listeners who are either budding writers, aspiring writers, first time writers, give them an idea of, you know, who you are from a credibility standpoint, because I think that's important when we have, you know, people like yourself on the show who write great books, but you're a great leader in the writing community, but you've also been recognized for a lot of the work that you've done. What are some of the highlights of your writing career?
Well, the highlight of my writing career was the Land Without Evil show. So my novel, Land Without Evil, is a historical novel, and it's about first contact between the Jesuits and the Indians in South America, but it's told from the Indians' point of view. So it's all about shamanism. This wonderful aerialist, director, producer, genius, Sarah Agent Red Johnson, she goes by Agent Red, she's originally from L.A., by the way, she put together a deal, and 50 people contributed, and we did 8 shows in Austin, Texas, with video projection, aerialists, costumes, dances, music, and everybody... Like the guy that played the shaman in the show did the music and he played the shaman, and another guy who played another part made costumes. And I mean, they all, 50 people contributed. And the making of the show was filmed by a show called Arts in Context, a PBS show. So the show about the making of the show got nominated for an Emmy. But
how
the show,
awesome is that?
Oh, it was a bomb. It was a bomb. The show was amazing. And to sit there, I was the only person in the entire cosmos who got to sit there through 8 shows front and center and to hear your dialogue being sung as a song.
Wow.
You know, I got every single night, every show, I got like really emotional about the whole thing.
Well, you'd have to.
Yeah, it was just a tremendously, and all these 50 people dedicated to telling my story. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that. You know, here's a funny thing. It's unusual for a novel to get turned into a show like that.
Ever.
It's even more unusual to get turned into a show with full-on aerialists and all that stuff. And all these amazing, amazing, amazing acrobats. But here's the funny part. My mother, she's left the planet some years ago. She was a famous child acrobat.
Oh, my gosh. So had to be there in, like, spirit.
I'm telling you, it was like her. It was like, I was sitting there every night in the front row, in my head, I'm going, wow, thanks, Ma. You know, like that. It was amazing. And if anybody pokes around on any of my stuff, you'll find links. There's pictures, there's videos, there's some acts from the show. The PBS show's up there, Arts in Context.
Land Without Evil. A little bit.
Yeah, exactly. It was just like Cirque du Soleil.
Okay.
That kind of aerialist activity.
I think that's totally... Okay, Matt, we've got about 5 minutes left in the show. I want to make sure we talk about anything else that you want to talk about before asking my two last... I'm going to ask you the two last questions now, but I want to talk about whatever you want to first. What advice would you give to budding writers, and then where can people stalk you on social media that you like to be stalked at? But before we get to those questions... What else do we need to know about you, what's going on in your world right now, things that are coming up?
Yeah, one thing for any budding writers out there, for sure, the Southern California Writers Conference San Diego is coming President's Day weekend here in San Diego, and it's a 3-day conference. I've been with them for 25 years. They're part of the home crew. And so it's a great experience for anybody who's writing at any level, even for the camaraderie. I mean, you know, you had a taste of it when you came to the Irvine one there.
Oh, my gosh. They're awesome.
Yeah, it's an amazing experience, and so that's highly recommended. And I'll be teaching, I'll be doing 3 late-night workshops there, and then I'll be lecturing on transformative narrative, and I'll be talking about writers' bios. I'll be doing a talk on that. And there are a number of other classes and different approaches that are being taught by my colleagues there. I'm just one of many.
So what would be something that is it would be crucial for a first-time attendee to either, A, make sure they do, or B, don't waste your time doing that because it's silly? You know, because a lot of times people come in with preconceived notions about, oh, I've got to make sure I do this and that and the other thing, and everybody else is there is like, oh, they're a first-timer. You know, do you have advice for folks?
Well, they should bring samples of their writing.
Okay.
Usually people who come to the conferences and are spending money and giving up their time and their hard-earned dinero to come have a commitment. Because, like, one of the things, like what I do in the late-night workshops is people read a sample of their work, and then we do an analysis of it. Jeff has done this with me a number of times. Jill has a couple of times, too. And then we do an analysis of their work and say, hey, this is working really great. I think you could work on this and make that better. It's always constructive, you know, never derogatory or having anything to do with content or anything, you know. It's all about, can we help make this writing better? And we all work together so everybody learns something. So it's very good like that. And you learn so much from other people. And also you're around other people who are struggling with the same things you are.
So it's also a great environment for people, you know, especially sometimes if you're a writer, or it can really be anything. You could be, you know, a doctor, a lawyer, or whatever. But when you come together with people who are doing what you do, you have such a sense of camaraderie and networking, I think, that it's really important for writers, I think, who can be a little bit isolated in their own world, to be able to go out and see other people who are doing what they're doing and to get a little encouragement and get some words of wisdom from experts like yourself.
And to sum that all up, basically finding their tribe.
Mm-hmm. Very important.
It's, you know, yeah, it's the whole camaraderie and family and community that's, you know, really the best. You know, I wouldn't, if it wasn't for, you know, Ray Bradbury and all those other people who took me under their wing when I was struggling and trying to figure it all out, you know. It's important for me to pass on that that tradition and that knowledge and that whole mindset, you know what I mean?
I agree. You know, the mentors that you have in your life, you know, make all the difference in the world. Okay, now we're down to the last 2 minutes of the show, Matt. So tell us where you'd like people to find you, and then advice that you give budding writers who are out there.
Yeah, okay. Well, writing is a discipline. If you're really beginning, you should show up at the same place at the same time every day, and your body will get into a rhythm, and a rhythm is what gets the job done. That's probably the best short piece of advice I can give. Your mind really gets into that mindset. All I have to do is Google my name. I have www.mattpalamary.com. That's my regular page, and I've got tons of pages all over the place. If they go on to Facebook, there's Matthew J. Palamary, and I'm on Twitter. I just Google my name, and I'll pop up all over the place. And you know, if you're interested in other things, you want to find out more about writing things, feel free to contact me. That's part of what I'm here for. And all my stuff about the ayahuasca and the visionary experiences, I want people to be responsible. I want it to be, it's not something to be messed with. It's not a lighthearted thing. It's a very, you know, thing that needs the ultimate respect. So I want to make sure people are properly educated. That's a big part of what I like to do.
Very good. Everybody, Matt's books are available on Amazon. There's a link on the show page. Go check that out. Support independent writers, musicians, filmmakers, any chance you have the opportunity. Matt, it's been a pleasure. I need you to come back. We're going to talk about so much more because we haven't even scratched the surface on half the stuff. But next time we'll pick another book and we'll showcase that for everybody. And again, just everybody, we're going to be back tomorrow night with Rated LGBT Radio with Rob Watson. Friday night it's Brad Schechter. And for everybody else, please do not drive distracted. We want you to come back. If you like the show, follow the show. You can also find us on iTunes as a podcast for Rated G Radio. And it's been my pleasure to have you here tonight, Matt. I sincerely thank you, and we'll see everybody live on Thursday night. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Matt.
All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.